The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. Another week, another good piece of vaccine news, or at least on the surface. James, can you give us an update on what you've heard about the Oxford vaccine?
So the news that we've had today on the Oxford vaccine is that it is 70% effective. That is not as good as Moderna and Pfizer, but it is a good result. I think a month or so ago, people would afford a 70% effective vaccine. It was a very positive outcome. The potentially more positive news is that they handed out the vaccine in two different ways. One way was 62% effective. That was two full doses. But when they gave people half a dose and then a full dose a month later, it was 90% effective in that. So there are signs that it might be slightly better than this 70% number. There are also signs that it stops the transmission of the virus as well as neutering the virus. Most importantly, from a UK point of view, is the UK has more than 100 million doses of this on order. And it means, the Oxford news means, the UK can now shift from a strategy of vaccinating the vulnerable to vaccinating every adult who wants it. And the significance of that is it means that by April, which is when we know from the leaked NHS documents that the Health Service Journal obtained, but that's when the government wants to vaccinate 75% of the population, that in April, nightclubs, all those kind of things will be able to reopen and operate as before. That there is a promise of a kind of snapping back to normalcy by April.
Fraser, is this a game changer?
I wouldn't call it that. I think the game changer came when Pfizer demonstrated that it had a vaccine with 95% efficacy. That was the game changer because that made basically was proof of concept that it was possible to vaccinate against a coronavirus, something that some people had thought wouldn't be possible only a few months ago. Now, once Pfizer was the first man on the moon, as it were, there on this particular moonshot, then you had Moderna, then now you've got Oxford. I'm not quite sure how seriously we should take the figure of 70%. On the face of it, it doesn't seem particularly encouraging. You've got the Oxford vaccine, which is cheap, but it's 70% effective, versus the Pfizer and Moderna one, which is 95%. I mean, given those figures, you would want, or you'd want your parents to have, the one that was 95% effective. But when you look in detail at the study, you see that there's still, this is being done quite quickly. And what's happened is that Oxford has had two regimens. One is where you give people two shots of it. That proved 62% effective. Then another regimen where you give them a half virus vaccine followed up by a full vaccine. And weirdly, the one and a half one proved 90% effective. The two full ones proved 62. Add together the 62 and the 19, you get an average of 70. So that's where 70 comes from. Now, what isn't clear to me yet is why the 62 figure is even relevant, because why would anybody go ahead with administering this vaccine in a way which they thought was less effective than giving half a dose and then a full dose afterwards? So it could well be that in the coming weeks and months, we might get a higher figure from Oxford and it might end up at 90%. After all, Pfizer was 90% before it increased it to 95% recently. So I think it's possible that Oxford does end up there with the Americans. But right now, there's so much that we still don't know. I'm not sure how comparable the studies are. We haven't probably been told. I mean, were they all looking at symptomatic or asymptomatic people? So it will take a few weeks, months for the data to settle. The upshot is, one way or another, we are going to have a vaccine-based route out of this mess. But what we don't know is how long that route will take. We don't know how long it would take to give everybody jabs. We do know with the Oxford one that Britain's ordered something like 100 million doses of this. Is that right, James?
100 million. And crucially, it only needs to be refrigerated, not kept in a kind of deep freeze.
So between 2 degrees and 7 degrees, that's very doable.
Which makes it very well suited, KB, to a nationwide immunisation programme, because you don't have those cold chain storage complaints. You know, Jamie wrote that very good piece for Coffee House about the kind of challenges of the Pfizer vaccine. Those don't apply to the Oxford vaccine.
James, Fraser's pointing out that although we have what appears to be very good news, we're not quite there yet. So when do we think we're going to hear that these vaccines have been approved for use? Because we keep hearing about leaked plans, discussed plans to roll out a mass vaccination programme. But all these different jabs have to get approval first, don't they?
I think very rapidly, because the regulator has been kind of conducting a kind of rolling review of the Oxford vaccine. So I would expect the health regulator to approve it, you know, within weeks. And I think they are... I think the government aren't quite confident that they will have started the process of jabbing people next month.
Well, with the great jab, hopefully beginning in around 4 weeks, Fraser, and we've got some other news coming up the track. We had over the weekend the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, confirming that lockdown will end on the 2nd of December. Boris Johnson is going to be giving us further details both today, but also as the week goes on in terms of what is replacing it. But we know it's a toughening of the three-tier system. So what can we expect in the months until a vaccine starts to have an impact on restrictions?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there are two ways of seeing the vaccine news, of course. One is hope that there has been a medical sort of lifeline thrown to us. The other is dismay at the notion of these restrictions lasting a lot longer, potentially, as a result of this, because the argument is a lot stronger now. Just let's keep hunkered down until April, May, whenever it is, that we think there'll be enough herd immunity to allow people to go out and about. But we also know that the virus this time around was falling before lockdown. Poor old Boris Johnson was bounced into this lockdown. I think he was quite angry to find out later on that when he stood in the House of Commons and said, talked about the doubling rate of the virus wasn't doubling at all, but falling. That's only obvious in retrospect now. We've got the ONS, which is whose surveys are, the closest we have to a gold standard of this now. So if there was never any need for national lockdown in the first place, which seems to be the case, then there's no reason why it should be extended on Wednesday next week when it will be lifted. So we're going to get some tougher tiers, but tougher in some ways but not in others. We're going to be able to go back to church, which obviously for churchgoers like me, that's a big thing. Pubs are going to be given a curfew of 11 p.m, not 10 p.m, so that's not quite as tough as it was before. But then again, if you want to drink in many areas, you'll have to order a substantial meal. But as other countries have shown, there are ways around that as well. Just I think in Ireland, you've got to spend €8 on a sort of pasty or something, and you can get around that. So I think we're going to live in this sort of strange twilight zone of local restrictions between now and in April. That's assuming there isn't a third wave, by the way. People haven't really discussed that yet. But if the second wave peaked mid-October, as it seems to have done in Liverpool in early October, then we can expect a sort of steady descent, one that will show through in hospital figures sooner or later and in deaths in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. We'll wait to see what the government's got in store for us, but I hope the narrative will be one of steady liberalisation, and I even more sincerely hope we can get around to talking about the damage sustained by lockdown and how we can go about repairing that damage.
Now, James, we know that although Boris Johnson hasn't set out himself all the specifics of this tier system, there's plenty that's been briefed out to the papers. There's already a backlash building in the Tory party. You have around 70 Tory MPs who want an economic impact. They want to know the impact on things like mental health, of continuing restrictions. How is he going to face that? Because ultimately, we expect this to go through regardless, potentially a vote next week. But Boris Johnson has Labour on side, doesn't he?
I think you will have the votes in the House of Commons, but no Prime Minister wants to rely on opposition votes to pass their legislation. I think his best case will be to essentially say, look, the vaccine news changes the dynamics of this conversation in that there is now the prospect of a stronger rebound for hospitality from the second quarter of next year. But I think he will have to provide some kind of economic impact assessment, because what they want to know, this kind of Steve Baker group of and Mark Harper group, is they want to know that the cure isn't worse than the disease. And I think he will have to show something that they have looked at the economic impact and the alternatives here. And I think the kind of question is whether... Now, I think the split side of this, as Fred said, is that we will probably... The vaccine news probably means that the temptation will be to kind of come out of this more carefully, because you know that there is a route out. Whereas you're not trying to learn to live with the virus as you were before, because you, in crude terms, won't need to from the second quarter of next year. But I think that, you know, Boris Johnson will have a tricky party management issue in the next few weeks. And it will be, I think it will be a first test, actually, of the slightly different approach to the parliamentary party that he is, you know, he and Downing Street have been attempting in the last week or so. You know, more consultation, more discussion. Does that ultimately get you to a better place or not? And this will be an interesting test of that.
But I wonder, James, I mean, I'm not sure that Number 10's got the apparatus to actually give a proper balanced assessment of situation. The template they've been using so far is there's a press conference, along comes Whitty and Valance, they give us some scary charts saying that things are all terrible, and the restrictions are announced, but at no stage is there any even pretense made to trying to assess the side effects of a lockdown. At no stage is there an economic impact. At no stage do we even hear about an error margin particularly. So the tactic they've shown right from the offset of this virus has been very one way. It's been just only talking about the virus and its likely effect. Never have we heard about the side effects. I would love it if the Prime Minister were to talk about the side effects and have a mature, grown-up conversation with the country, not just about the economic ones, but about the public health side effects. But it seems to me as if there's been almost a policy of not keeping a score of these things. And I wonder if he's likely to do it in such a short space of time.
Yeah, on that, James, do you think we are going to see Boris Johnson head towards a more adult conversation when he gives his, you know, statement to the nation tonight? There are certainly, you know, figures within Downing Street, there are officials who perhaps see the changing of the guard in terms of different people around the Prime Minister as a chance for a change in approach in terms of how he talks about coronavirus. Or do you think the fact that there does appear to be that good news that he's been waiting on for so long means that we could just have a situation where Boris Johnson is, you know, more optimistic than ever about just sticking with it for a little bit longer?
I think you are right that this vaccine news will push him towards a kind of slower, more careful route out. You know, we're so close to being through this crisis. Why rush out, essentially, I think, would be in crude terms. But I think set against that, I think the fact that there is now a way out means that you can, I think it is now easier for him to start talking more explicitly about the side effects of lockdowns, the damage they've done, because, you know, the danger for him was that he was going to be in a cycle where it was in, out, repeatedly. While as now, I mean, it doesn't look like it is. I mean, there is obviously a question as to whether you can get through January and February about having another lockdown. But I think it has become easier for him politically to talk about how he knows the damage that lockdowns have done in other areas. And I also think that some of the economic, some of the pressures from various industries will ease up because, you know, for example, the events industry have been very obviously, you know, one of the worst hit by this whole virus. You know, they now know that, you know, in terms of big weddings next summer, all that kind of stuff, they can now plan with confidence for those events, that those events will go ahead.
Good news, there's confidence for big weddings. I'll declare my interest shortly. Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.